Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcasts too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum. The power of sound in film. My guest Eric Adal says his job as a sound designer is to pull you into a film and not let go until the end. Half of the experience of a movie is the visuals coming at you, he says. The other half is the sound. We'll talk with Adal about how he recreated Godzilla's distinctive roar for Godzilla Kong the New Empire, and hear from you. What's a film that stands out to you for its sound? Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We tend to think of film as a visual medium, but without sound, we would not respond to movies the same way. It's the sound designer's job to create, sometimes from scratch, the monstrous roars, low hums, and deep growls. These are the sounds that immerse us into a story and trigger our emotions, and they can come from the most unexpected places. For Oscar-nominated sound designer Eric Adal, whose credits include A Quiet Place, The Creator, Argo, and Godzilla Kong, the sources of his sounds have included a grape, a plastic knife, and a car door. Eric Adal, it's so great to have you on Forum.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So that Godzilla growl we just heard in the intro that was in Godzilla versus Kong, I think, how did you create that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of experiment in what we do, and we might have a thousand different experiments before we stumble upon the right thing that feels right emotionally and in our gut. And obviously there's no 200-foot creature to go out and record as the voice of Godzilla. So we go into sort of the animal world and try to find analogs that work. And so for that particular growl you just played, we had the help of elephants. And in fact, one of the elephants was a former elephant of Michael Jackson, who lived on his Neverland Ranch.
Of course it was.
And now lives on a refuge in Lancaster, California, named Bo. And we spent a day just getting to know Bo and Bo's partner, Susie, and recording them. And elephants are capable of very sort of deep subharmonic sounds to communicate over vast distances. And that's one of the elephant's purrs that kind of started it. And then the raspy finish is a trunk exhale, which has sort of a little bit more rip to it. And then we play with the pitches of the sounds and layer them. And that was the sound you just heard.
Well, we have a clip of the elephants, the actual elephant sounds, the natural sounds. So let's hear that. Oh, wow. And then we have it slowed down. That almost doesn't even sound like a real elephant. And then we have it slowed down. So let's hear that too.
Okay.
I am starting to hear that Godzilla growl. So finally, here it is, slowed down and layered as you described, to create once again the Godzilla growl. And you turn to the animal world frequently, right? Maybe not even for gigantic reptiles.
No, that's right. I mean, there's an incredible world of sound in the animal kingdom. And we use everything from, you know, normal domestic dogs. I have four dogs at home and a chicken, and I try to record them all the time and put them in my movies. My oldest dog, Freya, I think was had in over a dozen different films playing all sorts of different things, from actual dogs to robots or whimpers for bear cubs in the movie Cocaine Bear. And we fostered a pig last year, and every time before feeding she would get very vocal, very excited about food and dinner, and that was when my rig was out and rolling and ready to capture everything she could do. And she wound up playing another character in the new Godzilla film named Chimo. Yeah.
Well, we'll definitely hear from them later in the show. But of course, we heard Godzilla's growl, but what Godzilla is best known for is that incredible roar, right? So actually, first, let's hear the roar you created for Godzilla Kong. Now, you told us that the growl was an elephant, but I understand you cannot disclose how you made the Godzilla roar. Why not?
Well, this is a great story. As we were finishing the film, Thomas Tull, who's the founder of Legendary Pictures, who produced the movie with Warner Brothers, he told me, "Eric, take it to your grave." And the reason being, you know, there's something of a magic trick with sound design, and you want your audience to be fully immersed and believe the sound they're hearing is totally organic and connected to the character. So, in fact, I didn't even tell Gareth Edwards, the director, how we did it until we had print-mastered the film and were completely done and ready for release, because I did not want him to think about how I made it every time he heard that roar. I just wanted to be believable as Godzilla. And so that's part of the secrecy of it. You know, you don't want to reveal the magic trick and have audiences just thinking about that versus the character himself. Yeah. But I can say that there were a lot of experiments that went into that roar. And, you know, I modeled it with the same sort of shape and cadence as the original 1954 roar, which was created by Japanese composer Akira Fukube. And his way of creating that roar was taking an instrument, a double bass string instrument, and then using a leather glove covered with pine tar to create friction. So when that glove ran across the strings of the instrument, he was able to perform it in a way that created that you know, sound.
Oh my God, that's so interesting, because when I was listening to the Godzilla roar, I did feel like it sounds a little bit like a cello to me, or maybe something along those lines, but I'm not going to make you say. But you know, the other thing that you're getting at with regard to not wanting to share the source is just how much sound design really is an art of illusion.
It is. And I consider it an abstract art. You know, when you're dealing with the image, with the picture, I find that there's far less leeway to use a totally different image for the image you're seeing on screen. But when it comes to sound, I can take something that has nothing to do with what you're seeing and manipulate it and have it work on a gut level. So oftentimes what you're hearing in a theater has nothing to do with what you're seeing on screen. So,
Exactly. So I think in the case of Godzilla's vocalizations, it is nothing to do with anything from the animal world. I mean, not that anyone would think Godzilla's an animal, but it's even more far removed than that, right?
That's right. And, you know, the whole goal with Godzilla is the character is a force of nature. There's something sort of primal and elemental and bigger than life and iconic. And so there, you're correct. There are no animal sounds in that roar. And I can kind of give one little hint, I think, without giving it away. But the main source material was an experiment that we did using super-cooled metals to create sort of that shriek sound.
Wow.
And then the second part of his roar is, after the shriek, is kind of the oomp. And I can tell you how we made that. And that was one of these serendipitous accidents. My creative partner, Ethan van der Rijn, and I were doing a different movie at the 20th Century Fox, and we were walking to the stage, and we heard this big cavernous kind of sound, and we're like, what the heck is that? And we snatched our rigs and went and found the source of the sound, and it was these big pallet racks of equipment being pushed around on polished concrete floors and creating that sort of deep friction sound. So then we musically manipulated that to form the tail of that roar.
All right. Well, I'm going to play a sound for our audience right now, and I want them to guess as they hear it what it is. This is something that you experimented with for one of Godzilla's vocalizations. Okay, so what were we listening to there, Eric?
So that was a recording I did a couple of years before I started the movie. And again, this was one of those happy accidents. I was recording 70s era cars for the movie Argo, which takes place in 1979 in Tehran, Iran. And as I did that recording, I thought, man, this car door is talking. And it was an old Plymouth car door that I was moving around. And I put that kind of in my back pocket for a future creature movie. And then sure enough, Godzilla came along, and I was trying to create sort of varieties of agitation vocals for, in particular, the Golden Gate Bridge sequence, where Godzilla is getting bombarded with tank fire and is getting attacked and breaks through the entire bridge. And I created a whole set of recordings using that one car door creak, minutes of it. And I put it on the keyboard with, you know, and sample it and then use pitch wheel and kind of perform them live to get many different sort of variations and nuances to use for that.
Yeah. So, well, let's hear the Godzilla vocalization that resulted from the car door. I love hearing about all the happy accidents in your process. And listeners, we'll have more with Eric Adal and how he gets inspired and gets ideas for the sounds that he uses right after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about sound in film with the Oscar-nominated sound designer Erica Dahl, who's worked on films including A Quiet Place, Argo, The Transformers, and Kung Fu Panda series, The Creator, and Godzilla Kong, A New Empire. And you, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. What movies stand out to you for their sound? Or what's a sound effect that you remember? Or maybe there's just a sound that always affects you or triggers emotion. You can tell us that too. Have you ever wondered about how a sound effect was made? Feel free to ask Eric what it's like to be a sound designer. You can email forum@kqed.org. Find us on our social channels on X, Instagram, our digital community on Discord. You can call us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, because we love hearing the sound of your voice. This listener writes, a lot of Star Wars sound effects are so iconic. Lightsabers, ships turning on, flying and jumping into hyperspace, blasters, monsters, and aliens. It really brings the whole world to life. And Navacyclical on Discord writes, I'm not at all a Star Wars person, but Darth Vader's signature deep breathing was actually the voice actor breathing off a scuba regulator. So, Eric, you grew up in the Bay Area. You went to USC Film School. What made you choose sound to devote your art to?
Well, you know, it really began as a five-year-old starting to play piano. And a couple years after that, you know, we had a computer in the house. And this was back in the days of old computers and DOS and... But I had a soundboard that I realized I could connect up to a MIDI keyboard. And so that's when I started sort of experimenting with, you know, electronic sound. And this was all for fun, you know, growing up in middle school and high school, I never thought I'd be going into sound or filmmaking. I didn't realize, oh, you can have a career out of that. So it was all just for the joy of it. And when I originally enrolled in Stanford to start college, and immediately had trouble sleeping, and I was nauseous, and I thought maybe I'd closed a door to this passion of mine. So I called up USC and asked if I still had my scholarship and I could enroll late. And fortunately, they said, "Yep, come on down." In film school, I got obsessed with sound, and I was supervising the John Williams scoring stage on campus and designing sound. And I'd sneak into the Foley studio at night to record. And then just fortunately after film school was hired on the first season of NYPD Blue as an assistant. That's kind of how I got into it. Yeah. And
you've talked about how you consider sound to be a sense that's akin to touch. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's true. So it literally is touch. When a sound wave travels through any medium and touches your body, so sound travels through not just air, but planet Earth itself. Like when you're hearing an earthquake, you're hearing the power of the sound. And we use sound to measure the intensity of an earthquake with seismographs. And sound travels faster through metal than it does through air. And so sound is just the very touch of a railroad track to know when a train is coming before the sound tells you that. So sound as touch is very much how I think about it. And in fact, when you're in a theater, when you're hearing the subwoofer, it's not just the frequencies your ear is hearing that are going into your cochlea and exciting the fibers in your ear, the your brain then translates into neural impulses that are your brain will interpret. There's also the solidian sound, where your entire body can resonate with certain frequencies. And I find it fascinating that that ability evolved before, evolutionarily, before sight evolved. So it's a very primal part of our very consciousness. And in that way, it can work very subliminally and emotionally. And this, you know, this is the power of music and creating mood. And with sound design, we can create mood and manipulate sound, where you can close your eyes and, oh, that's a dangerous sound because of what frequencies and timbres are being used, or a very soothing sound like a baby cooing or an ocean wave. So these are kind of the tools of sound design that I often think of us as puppet masters, in an invisible way, manipulating the emotion of the audience's experience.
Wow. Let me go to caller Heather in Napa. Heather, you're on.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. You know, I just, listening to this, it's always amazing to me to, you know, all the different sounds that come up in movies. But as little kids, we had a sound effects record that we used to listen to. And we'd just sit there as little kids and try and guess what, you know, the sound was coming from. You know, and you had to look at the back of the record album to figure out what it was. And then just a quick question, you know, we have a hummingbird feeder that we have, I don't know, up to 15 hummingbirds in the summer that feed off of it. And I have recorded them in slow motion. And I'm just wondering if you've ever used any hummingbird noises in any of your movies.
Oh, Heather, wow, you're a sound designer. Have you ever used any hummingbird noises, Eric?
I have. I mean, my two favorite sounds that hummingbird makes are they're flying. You know, they sound like a big buzz, voom, voom, for air. So I've used that for different particle buys in film. And I also love their vocals. Those are hard to record. You need the microphone in the right place. I happen to have a fountain in my yard that hummingbirds feed on every day. And the trick is to get them close and then turn off the pump so that's not messing up the recording, and then get their chirps when they're hovering around there. And the chirps I've used for electronic button sounds for sci-fi movies like Pacific Rim 2, for example. A lot of those bleeps and bloops are little hummingbird chirps.
Well, since we're talking about the animals around you, I do want to hear the sound of your dog.
Okay.
So let's hear it right now. And which dog is this?
This is my dog, Kimchi. She's a Shih Tzu poodle. And to get that recording, obviously you have to take your dog's collar off and have them in a quiet space. And in that situation, she was laying on her back in our bed, getting belly rubs, and she was playing. She was like very excited. So that's a little 10-pound Shih Tzu poodle.
And your dog really is named Kimchi. Okay, I love that.
Yep.
So tell me, what did you use Kimchi's bark for?
I've used her for a couple of things. Slowed Down, I've used her for creature vocals, also in Godzilla. Sped Up, in one of the Transformers films, I used her for a feisty little clock robot who, in the story, she was the robot that killed Hitler, which is not historically accurate, but pitched up, she had, it's even more ferocious in a way.
So I understand that Kimchi is also Kong's breaths and snorts. So let's hear a little bit of that.
Thank you.
I love that gigantic gong sound is from your pet dog.
You know, I find that oftentimes you can find the macro in the micro when it comes to sound. Mm-hmm. Sound is so scalable. And oftentimes smaller sounds, you actually get a better bass response to create that size when you slow it down. And, you know, one of the techniques I use is I use scientific microphones, which capture frequencies far beyond the range of human hearing. But when I take those recordings back into the studio, slowed down, they maintain all of the high-end fidelity. So they don't sound muffled and slowed down, but they still sound crisp and but big and have weight. So, yeah, it's funny. Some of my favorite tiny sounds become really big sounds. Like I've used a single bloink of a drop of water to create an explosion in the first Kung Fu Panda movie, for example.
Oh my gosh. That's incredible. Well, speaking of small, you also used your little pet pig, right, to be the ice beast or to be Shimo. That's what you were mentioning earlier.
That's right. Her name is Lily, and she lived with us with 3 months before we could adopt her out. And every dinner time, pigs are so smart, by the way. They're perhaps smarter than dogs. And she knew as soon as one compartment of the fridge would open that her dinner was about to be prepared. So I always had my rig on hand and to get her vocals, her excited vocals and grunts and squeals, just not knowing even what I was going to use them for. When the character Shimo came up, I thought, oh yeah, this will be perfect because I can use one singular sound that's not layered, which is my preference. I like to keep sounds very elemental and pure and not have, you know, 100 tracks playing at once. That's something I do not like to do, but.
Let's play your pig squeal. And then also hear what you did to it to create the roar of the ice beast. Okay. And here's the ice beast. So you were saying that you like to keep things simple. Is that a common mistake of sound designers to get too layered in their sounds?
Yeah, it's something I see all the time and I try to avoid. Sound in a way is a lot like painting. You know, you have a set of frequencies and the more you layer those frequencies, the more diluted they get. And with the painting metaphor, it's kind of like taking all the colors on the palette and mixing them together. And the color you get is brown, which is not the sonic color I want to get. I want something that's very vibrant and pure and expressive. So the first thing I do with junior editors working with me is sort of coach them on simplicity. Like if you can use one sound, that will be the purest version of what it is. And it's actually easier not to have a million tracks that you have to sift through and then the mixing process becomes a nightmare. The hard part is getting the right sound that you're going to use.
Right.
So, and all of my favorite sounds in film history are not layered. They're singular, like the sound of R2-D2's voice. It's a string of sounds, but there's no layering to them. And this was the brilliance of Ben Burtt, who designed the Star Wars movies. But same thing for Chewbacca. It's one sound. It's the sound of a baby cub bear chatting. So, yeah.
One of our listeners actually wrote, it was fun to learn that most of the sounds that Chewbacca made in the Star Wars movies were recorded from a bear's growls. Another comment on point is Ted, who writes, I just watched Oppenheimer. The movie was ruined for me by a continuous, gratuitous rumbling sound, even during indoor conversations. And another listener asks, do you have any pet peeves when it comes to sound work in movies? When I first learned about the Wilhelm scream, it was always really funny to be able to pick it out. But now I hear it everywhere, almost to the point of distraction.
Yeah, the Wilhelm scream, that was something that Ben Burtt dug out of the 20th Century Fox library. And it became kind of like an insider joke, like you used it everywhere. Used it in the first Star Wars where a stormtrooper falls into a shaft. It was used in third Star Wars film for Boba Fett falling into the pit of Sarlacc. It's used in Raiders of the Lost Ark for a Nazi falling off of a moving truck. And it became kind of like an insider joke to put that everywhere. I used it once. In the first Kung Fu Panda. And then I decided, let's come up with a new joke because this one's getting old. And so I started using a goat scream, which has been in movies like World War Z and a few others.
Well, let me go to caller Liz in San Francisco. Liz, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling from San Francisco. And I also went to film school at USC, and I at one point really wanted to pursue film design, but got kind of a little intimidated by the electrical engineering part of it. But I remember that Foley Room. That Foley Room is amazing. Kenny Hall was one of my professors there. It's just kind of nice to hear you talk about it. One of the things that my friends find kind of funny about me is that when we're watching a movie, I'll point out the sounds because I'm like, oh, I wonder where they source that from. I wonder what they did to that sound to make it sound that way. People don't realize that it is truly magical. And when you talk about it being like a form of touch, that's totally true. So I just appreciate the conversation.
Oh, Liz, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, we've been talking about really kind of loud sounds, but for your film, The Quiet Place, you have to tell a lot of the story through silence. How did you approach that as the sound designer for the film?
Well, you know, sound is in the DNA of the movie A Quiet Place. It's the kind of a central character in a way. This family has to adapt to a world where sound is danger. And if you make too much sound, you are going to attract these creatures who have hypersensitive hearing and die. So the family, you know, obviously in the story has created all of these survival techniques for laying out sand paths and walking barefoot so they won't be stepping on twigs and calling attention to themselves. There's a whispering sort of in their bunker where they feel safer. And when one scene in the film has an actual conversation, but it's next to a waterfall. So the sound of the waterfall masks their talking, and so they can communicate safely. So the sound is built into the DNA of the storytelling. So the first thing we realized was we need to establish that starkness and that quiet. And then when we do get big, that's where danger happens.
So interesting, because in this case, it's not just the sound telling the story, but the sound is also a really important character of the story. We're talking about the importance of sound in film. It often doesn't get recognized as much as a film's visual elements, and Erica Dahl is telling us why it should. Stay with us for more after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and we're talking about sound. We're talking about how sound effects are made, going over the methods that sound designers use to get their unique sounds and the unlikely sources that inspire them and the power it has to evoke emotion. We're talking with Erica Dahl, sound editor and sound designer, co-founder of the sound company E Squared. His credits include Argo, Transformers, Kung Fu Panda, The Creator, Godzilla, Kong, and A Quiet Place. And before the break, Eric, we were talking about A Quiet Place and about, you know, sort of the monsters in the film. One of the things that you needed to create was the sound of them using, and I guess this is a mini spoiler, so mini spoiler here, but the sound of them using echolocation to track down their prey. How did you come up with the sound for echolocation?
Yeah, so this was kind of a very interesting concept to us. We kind of considered the creatures as essentially blind, but they have hypersensitive hearing. And so they use echolocation to navigate their geography and hunt their prey. And so sort of the first part set of experiments we used for echolocation was using real analogs in the animal world that do use echolocation, like bats, dolphins, a lot of marine life have these clicks that they put out. And when the sound reflects back to them, they can interpret the 3D space around them, what's moving, and so on. And we thought, okay, this is kind of a great start. So we used dolphin recordings and beluga whale recordings, bats. All of it felt a little too familiar. So, and here was another happy accident where we're thinking, okay, what other things make kind of clicking sounds that we can manipulate to use for that navigation through the environment? And one thing we stumbled upon was a taser we had here in the studio. I've got it right next to me, and it, you know, it makes an electric clicking sound, and but when used against different surfaces that can conduct electricity, it creates a really nice clicking. And we used that recording, slowed it down, manipulated the clicks, gave them a little reverb to reflect to the environment. And that became the vocal's main sort of searching echolocation sounds.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so let's hear this taser, which I'm so glad to hear you just have on hand. Taser. Let's hear this taser on a grape. And now let's hear the alien creature clicks from A Quiet Place. Ooh, so cool. We're talking with Erica Dahl, and so are you, listeners, telling us what movies stand out to you for their sound or a sound effect that you remember well. Questions that you have for Erica Dahl about sound design. Jeff writes, my favorite film sound design is in Apocalypse Now. The layered sound design often perfectly suits the chaos on the screen. Reed writes, I was working at Skywalker Sound when Jurassic Park was being made. One day, a professional handler brought in a Komodo dragon to the Foley stage to try and coax useful growls and other sounds. The beast was uncooperative and managed to slice the handler's arm with its tail after being provoked. They went for another less risky way to obtain the animal sounds after that. What's the most dangerous thing that you've ever done to get a sound, Erica Dahl?
The most dangerous stuff. Well, the obvious stuff might be, you know, doing things like weapons or explosions. For the first Kung Fu Panda film, we did an entire set of fireworks recording. And we went to a reservation in Nevada where we could legally do it and do a big setup. And we did things like put stakes in the ground and set up 50 feet of high tension wire that we could thread rockets to, and then set up microphones along the wiring array to get the Doppler by of these fizzing rockets. And one of the more powerful rockets went all the way to the end of the zip line and then still had enough power to snap out of its harness and then fly about 100 feet into the air over a hill. And we all rushed over the hill and found it on fire. of course, we had a whole crew there with who was able to put it all out, and that was safe. But, you know, and then on the other end, maybe the only time I've ever jumped while doing a recording was I was recording a tiger, and it was feeding time. And we were between bars, so I felt safe. But I got my microphone a little too close to the stake, and the tiger got very territorial over her meal and let out this giant roar. And just the primal part of my body just jumped. I just had no, it really was a shock.
Yeah.
But in general, we try to be very, very safe with what we do. We don't want anybody on the crew to be injured. We try to do everything in a very controlled environment.
Yeah. Let me go to caller Jeff in Hayward. Jeff, you're on.
Hi. The first movie I ever really noticed sound on was Eraserhead. I would agree with the previous caller that many times you say, did you notice that? And they never did. But anyway, I just wonder if there's any like industry opinion about that, because that was the first time I ever watched a movie. Like, the sound was almost another character, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. David Lynch is one of my favorite filmmakers with sound. And in fact, he takes a sound designer credit on his films, I think, just because sound is such an integral part of his storytelling and creating mood. And I would rank Eraserhead as one of my favorite soundtracks, just because of how bizarre and out of the box it is. And one of the icons in sound, Alan Splett, was responsible for that track with David Lynch. But yeah, that's a classic film for creating a very deep sense of unease using sound. And like you said, it might be invisible to the audience what it is that's manipulating that emotion, but it's very much the alchemy between sound and picture.
You actually capture sounds that humans can't hear that are either above or below our range. How do you do that?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people forget that we as humans have a very limited range of perception with sound. We can hear between 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. 20 kilohertz is the very top range. And as you age, that goes down. You know, you might wind up at 10 kilohertz top perception. But other animals in the animal kingdom hear lower than us. Like dogs, for example, can sense earthquakes before we can, because they can hear those subliminal, subharmonic sounds. And they can also hear over twice as high frequencies as we can, going up to 50,000 hertz. And some creatures like minke whales can hear 120,000 hertz, which is, you know, six times our perception of sound. So there's this entire kind of invisible world beyond our threshold of hearing that is fascinating. And there's so much information up there that's untapped. And with the technology we have today, we can capture those sounds. And when you're doing the recording, you don't necessarily hear it. But once you bring it into the studio, you can see all of those frequencies and then pull them into the range of human hearing. And there's often some very fun surprises lurking up beyond our threshold of hearing.
Well, you have shared with us what it sounds like with that equipment, because we wouldn't be able to hear it normally, when you just sort of drag a plastic knife and straw on rubber or something like that. So let's hear it. That almost ran right through me. This is the sound slowed down to 10% of regular speed. And here's the same sound slowed down to 1% of regular speed. Whoa, what did you use that for? Or did you use it?
I did use it. That was one of our many experiments on the 2014 Godzilla. And the slowed down version we wound up using for the brood of baby Mutos who have, there's a hive in San Francisco. Any one of these Mutos can destroy the city. And you see a scene where there's hundreds of them. So for the little vocals of them in their egg sacs, that was the slowed down version of that serrated knife rubbing against a rubber tire.
Oh, wow. Well, Gio Norva on Discord writes, do studios keep databases of sounds for new Foley artists to get started with, or does each artist build their own database from scratch?
So there are libraries that are available commercially. I do not use those. I like to use my own recordings and my own design. So I've built my own extensive library since I've started over the last 25 years. And it's just from everything. Every trip I take, I have my rig with me. And when the magic appears, I'm ready to record it. And all of those get databased in by show with tag numbers and descriptions and metadata. So of the tens of thousands of recordings I've done, I can easily call them up in the database and pull them in into a session to play with.
We're talking with sound editor and sound designer Eric Adal. And let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Let me go next to caller Steven in San Francisco. Steven, you're on.
Hi, good morning. I'm curious if your artist has watched the film The Zone of Interest by Jonathan Glazer, because I found it to be a remarkable parallel track of sound design with a completely muted visual take on what happened during the Holocaust. The sound design was remarkable. So I'm just curious if you saw it.
Thanks.
Yes, I did see it. And in fact, I was sitting with the nominees at the Oscars. I was there with the creator. And when they won, and deservedly so. And that's an example of just on a script level, using sound as another character, where there's an entire off-screen story that's conveying the horrors of the camp, the concentration camp that this family is living right next to. And they're going through their daily domestic, you know, what is this? How does this dress look on me? Or having a picnic. But in the background is this entire other story going on sonically about this sort of horrific environment that that they're living in. So yeah. I thought it was a brilliant use of sound to convey the horrors of that war, juxtaposed with the triteness of domesticity. And and I love when you can contrast those sort of things in film. You know, in a very different way, Scorsese did it with Goodfellas, where there's people getting shot, but we're playing, you know, needle drop fun contemporary music. And so that alchemy is a very fascinating one that I think is very emotionally, but also thought provoking. So Zone of Interest, definitely, you know, I admire any film that uses sound to create a whole nother feeling and story to it. So I applaud that.
Well, speaking of which, Larry writes, for Oppenheimer, I recognize that the sound design is bothersome for a lot of viewers, but for me, it further put me into this mad scientist's head. That ever-present rumble someone commented on earlier seemed to indicate something not right in Oppenheimer's mind or spirit, a disconnect between his heart and mind, maybe. I love all these people who are so attuned to sound because it so often is, you know, we're sort of oblivious to it, even though it's having such a profound impact on us. We heard you do sort of the plastic knife on rubber, but you don't always manipulate objects to make sound. Like for Argo, you really did record people speaking Farsi on the street, right?
No, that's right. And that was maybe one of the most important sound elements of the movie. Ben shot Argo in Istanbul, and the film starts with the 1979 siege of the American embassy in Tehran, and there's massive protests with 10,000 of people outside of the gates of the embassy chanting, and there's a number of different chants that we used. Unfortunately, because we shot it in Istanbul, we had no Farsi speakers as all of the extras. They were all Arabic speakers. And so we wound up having to create all of those chants. And the way we did that was we got about 100 extras, all native Farsi speakers, out onto the Warner Brothers back lot. So we had the proper exterior reverberation and the reality of being outdoors and city streets. And we had them do a whole set. There were 7 different chants we did, and then did a whole bunch of other variety of things with them, with we call them voice artists, loop group artists. And to the point where I had them like rocking my truck with the microphones inside it and getting the sounds of the protests from behind windows and up on top of rooftops. And of course we were working with an expert, language expert there. And afterwards, when we wrapped, it turned out to be just the most emotional experience. Many of our voice talent had actually been there, at those protests in 1979, and were crying and recollecting what the experience was like, and to me that brings not just reality but emotion to a sequence like that.
Yeah, is there a sound? We just have 30 seconds left, but is there a sound, Eric, I don't know, that you consider so incredibly moving or beautiful that it's brought you to tears?
Yeah, you know, there's so many beautiful sounds, but maybe my favorite is just a very personal recording that I did with my mother before she passed away. And that's something I like to listen to frequently. And to me, my sound collection is kind of like a diary of my whole career. And I can go back to any recording and feel like I'm there in that moment. And my recording of my mom is one of those.
What a beautiful diary. Eric, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And listeners, thank you for sharing the sounds that have affected you in film. And thanks, Mark Nieto, for producing today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.